Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast. I'm Matt Cause. That's Bob Mackowitz. Bob, we got a lot to cover today, don't we?
We sure do. It feels like it's pretty gray out today and sort of drizzly. And there's a term in literature studies called pathetic fallacy.
That is correct.
The outside world mirrors your internal state.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Toronto, after what, like winning, 12-4 and then seeing the Nats were up, 5-3, 5-2, 5-1, like just to lose 7-5, man. Oh, I tweeted out, on the scale of Toronto sport gut punches, this is an 8.2 out of 10.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's so much. I'm not even going to start with my shrimp observation that I have from this morning. Let's start here. The idea of unfair is one that we push back on in the world of sports, because sports is about the ultimate meritocracy. Whether you believe that or not, it's fine. But the idea of unfair, we don't like to do. But I'm looking at the Jays and this season, and Dunedin, Buffalo, and I understand COVID has ravaged planet Earth far more than the Blue Jays home record. We all acknowledge that. But all of that hurt the Jays. And then being in the American League East so hurt the Jays. It just feels unfair today that team with those players is not in the playoffs.
You know who this team reminded me of after the sad news that the Yanks and Sox had won? It reminded me of the late 90s Jays, the early 2000s Jays, those Carlos Delgado squads. In that they were really good teams, and they, would always finish third behind the Yanks and the Sox. And we had Roy Halladay, who was probably one of the best, if not the best pitchers in the American League. We had Carlos Delgado, who was like not just a star, but a superstar. We had Sean Green, who was an amazing player. Like, there were a lot of good players that were cycling through that team. But there was also, it felt like we had packed for a hike, and the Yankees and the Sox were a mountain.
Yeah, we had a sleeping bag. They were glamping.
Yeah, but to go back to the thing about COVID, you're right, and there's nothing we can do about it. And we can talk about May, because it feels like, they won 91 games, but they also went on an incredible heater over the last couple months. So it feels like in the typically cruel way of baseball, you can't win it in May, but you sure can lose it. How do you feel about that, Matt? The idea that this was lost not by the squad in September, but by the squad in May.
It's true. They started the year 9-11 in their first 20. Mm-hmm. They were 33-35 after a 7-1 loss to Baltimore. They split that four game series with a Twins team that would win 73 games. If there's one thing we're reminded of, is that it's easier to slush off, whatever word you want to use, a May loss, but they can bite you in the ass, and it did this time.
You think about all of those late inning fuck-ups where the bullpen would just hand back games, like they'd be handed a substantial lead only to blow it in the last three innings. And I've heard people criticize management for saying they didn't address that fast enough. That doesn't strike me as entirely fair. We can get to the manager in a minute, but in terms of like the talent that was provided for this team, they did a lot at the trade deadline and it put them in a very competitive place. And I don't feel it's fair that the team didn't adequately respond out of the gate to a roster challenge. What do you think?
No, if you for me, very little of this goes on Montoyo. This goes on dumb. It doesn't. It, to me, where this goes more on is we can look at the bullpen, and the bullpen was bad. The stats really back it up. But Toronto There was a stat from Steve Simmons. The Blue Jays lead all of baseball in wins versus teams over 500. They have 21 more wins against winning teams than the White Sox, who won the Central Division. The White Sox faced four teams in the AL Central, all with sub 500 records. The Jays had the Washington Generals, that was the Boston or the Baltimore Orioles. Everyone else won 90 plus games. You know, this is a case where if the Jays are in any other division, they're making the playoffs. And I know you can talk about the National League West. Well, the American League East collectively had more wins than the National League West, even with the behemoths of the Dodgers and the Giants. So when I look at this, I mean, Montoya gets some blame. The bullpen gets a lot of blame. But a lot of this just comes down to the fact that the Jays had to face a far harder schedule than so many other teams that are in the playoffs today.
It's late-stage capitalism, Matt. Not to turn this into a political seminar, but when you have no salary cap, now the Rays, you can argue, have the same obstacle. That's a wholly different issue. But the fact is that you've got two of the biggest organizations in MLB in your division, and they spend. Yeah. And they've always spent. You know, the fact that Aaron Judge, you know, hit that game-winning run in the ninth, the game-inning single, it just makes sense, right? Like, because, you'd, of course, it would be one of their acquired boppers that would do it.
Yeah.
They're built for that sort of thing. They are who they are. Now they're going to throw, is it Garrett Cole in the wild card game? They plucked him off the vine, too. I'm not going to disparage the Yanks. We all know those great Yankees teams developed the core four, and you know they're a great organization. But the fact is simply this. It, to your point, is harder to compete in the AL East than it is anywhere else. This is what makes me a little nervous about the future, as we discussed in our last pod, is that, you know, I think the Jays are obviously an excellent team, but does being an excellent team get it done? Well, this year it landed us in fourth. I don't know how to feel about that. I want to be excited to say, wow, they've accumulated these amazing young resources. But they were fourth out of five, Matt.
They were. If they had average bullpen, they would have been better than that. Also, here's another thing. Them being fourth, let's go back to COVID. They were basically a 500 team in Dunedin and Buffalo. They were like 25-11 at Skydome. They play in Toronto the whole year. They're in the playoffs. It's as simple as that.
Probably. Like, it's probably worth at least one win. Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, to your point, it's a really interesting one. It sounds like a simple one, but it's a very sophisticated one, that sports aren't supposed to be about fairness. They're supposed to be about winning. But that's with the idea that all sports, like, you have an equal playing field, that the rules apply to everybody, everybody has a chance to succeed. But then you kind of ask yourself, with the way that the Jays have been handed things because of COVID, and certainly the Raptors the previous year, it really wasn't the same, was it? And we've seen this in other sports, like New Orleans is decimated, so the team has to go play in Oklahoma. Like, sometimes you just have to say, this year won't be fair for you guys. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, and that's sort of where I look at this more big picture than Montoya screwing up in the seventh inning in May. And we always get nervous about fair. And by the way, Bob, in case you bring it up, the one team, if they want to go hold my beer when it comes to fairness, is the LA Dodgers, who won like 104 or 5 games and at a plus 200, whatever, one differential.
106.
They've got 106 wins. They've got a wild card game like tomorrow or the day after.
And they
got
to face Adam Wainwright with one shot to make it to the playoffs.
Yeah, the super red hot Cardinals. So the Jays, you know, there are other teams out there that can have a claim about unfair. But like, Bob, you mentioned Roy Halladay. How many years did he lose the Cy Young because of some motherfucker in the American League Central who gets to pitch against Kansas City and horrible Cleveland teams and bad White Sox teams while there's Roy Halladay in Fenway in Yankee Stadium starting 6-7 games against those behemoths? Like, it's just, it's once again, the goddamn American League East versus the Central.
Well, it's interesting because strength of schedule needs to be more and more factored in, and all kinds of things do. I remember being on the air during the great Cabrera versus Trout MVP debate, because it wasn't just a battle between two teams. It was a battle between how do you quantify excellence in baseball? And it really was the first time that you saw the smart analytics poke holes at what were the traditional behemoth numbers, right? Like Cabrera had an incredible year, but time and time again, you just kept saying, but Trout did this, but Trout did that. And there was just so much more sophisticated. You know, Roy Halladay might have been the best pitcher of his era if you look at the obstacles he had to face.
Yes.
You know, in the same way, like, it's almost like if this was college football before they had a playoff system, and you kind of just had to take a look at strength of schedule and quality of wins and say who looks the best, the Jays wouldn't have been the eighth best team. They probably would have been in the top five.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's like I've always been such a firm believer in the context of degree of difficulty. And we don't need to go down this road of the Brett Favre conversation. But whenever people get bug-eyed at me when I have Favre ranked higher than a lot of other quarterbacks, I just always like to remind people, outdoors, hurts numbers, era where it was harder to pass, playing against Steve Young in the 49ers and Aikman in the Cowboys, and it's not like he had a lot of weapons around him. I always just, to me, degree of difficulty needs to be mentioned, and the Jays had a far higher degree of difficulty than some of these other teams making the playoffs.
Why do they have weight classes in boxing, Matt?
Exactly. Because it's not fair, you know, for the heavyweight to be taking on, you know, a little guy where one punch ends it.
It feels like the Jays were the fourth best team in the heavyweight division, but pound for pound, much higher ranked than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, the Rays, you can make the case that the Rays have, you know, done an amazing job with the same obstacles, if not bigger ones. And that's a separate argument. But I don't think it's fair to say the Jays suck because the Rays are great. That seems to be a very specific and selective argument. I think what's probably truer to say is that life in the AL East isn't fair.
Yes. Yeah. Tip your cap. You can both tip your cap to Tampa. What they've done year after year is incredible. And this feels like I'm now working on Wednesday's opening thought. But it's incredible. Incredible what they've done. Because it is. It's harder in the American League East. Not every year, but 8 years out of 10, it's just tougher. Do you want to hear a quote, Bob, that probably means nothing but will make you feel 4% better this morning?
Yeah, sure.
This one from Rob Longley, who covers the Blue Jays for the Toronto Sun. Quote from Marcus Semien on pending free agency. We had the best offense in the major leagues and the best starting pitching in the game. How could you not want to be a part of that? Please. Yeah. I mean, I know I'm holding on to this like Kate Winslet in the Arctic Ocean. But my message to Rogers, if it's just about money, get it done.
Right. And there's an interesting challenge for Rogers here, because ever since the Anthopoulos era ended, they've been building to this moment where the team is good enough that everybody should pay attention. They went through some lean years. They went through some years where it was a little unsure. Are we rebuilding? What's the deal? But there's no question about it now. They invested in young talent. That young talent is ready to win. They showed what happened when you can surround that young talent with some seasoned talent. And now it's time to hold this sucker together. And maybe it is just money. Maybe it isn't. Maybe Robbie Ray just goes out and says, you know what? I miss Florida sunshine. And he goes and plays, you know, for the Marlins. Who knows, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah, it can be.
If you have a chance to outbid someone, you have to.
It could be family, like Kawhi Leonard. It's like, hey, there's nothing you can do. But if it's just about money, and also Bob, Alec Manoah, Nate Pearson, Bo Bichette, Vlad Guerrero Jr., none of them are going to be making much money next year just because arbitration, just the way baseball is with young players.
It's a great point. You've made this point so many times about Steph Curry and the Golden State Warriors and how they never become a dynasty if there isn't a freak accident, like injury, that keeps him from making the kind of money he could have when he could have. It kept the cap a little bit cleaner for them to make some other moves. And then you have a dynasty like baseball. has the cruelties of the no cap, but the arbitration rules do allow you to hang on to some of this young talent and make the most out of them. You know, you do have that advantage as a team, and they got to take it. The window is clearly now. Everybody knows this. They were a terrific team to watch. They were a hell of a lot of fun. Haven't been this excited since 2015 about the Jays, and that was a hell of an exciting squad. This team feels like it could put its stamp on Jays history, and there have been some pretty effing amazing clubs. And it's, to your point, it's interesting because this dredges up old fears that I'm not sure are relevant. I don't expect Rogers to be cheap. They have been in the past, but wouldn't you be shocked if they entered this offseason cheaply?
I'll give them benefit of the doubt. Ryu a couple years ago, George Springer last year. Yeah. Also, look at it. Like, look at how good this team could be. You bring those guys back. The amount of eyeballs watching Rogers watching Blue Jay games where Rogers can just throw every promo for everything they've got, including that guy with the beard and the turtleneck. You know, you're going to be getting sellout or whatever sellout crowds look like next year. I mean, the Blue Jays are a cash cow when they're relevant, and they are really, really relevant. And next year, Gary Trent Jr. will be making like $16 million more than Vlad Guerrero Jr.
You should use that stat on your show. It's pretty great.
I thought about that a second ago, and I'm already Microsoft wording it. I'm putting that in my opening thought, which I already wrote. I'm going to throw that line in.
Now, in fairness, it's more of a symbolic stat in the sense that the economics of both sports are different. But still, if you're talking about just general cheapness, if you're not willing to pay for somebody and you're getting Vladdy Guerrero for $16 million less than Gary Trent Jr.,
yeah,
it's kind of hard to forgive. I don't think that's going to be the case, though. I feel pretty strongly that one of Simeon or Ray will be back, and ideally it'll be both. And that's not to say that with this amazing opportunity for a player to come here, like, it's always so good for an organization when a guy like Simeon has the year that he did, because he took a flyer on the Jays to rehab his image and his career. And he has. You got this a bit with the Raptors too, right? It's like you can go there, look good, and then make money. These guys are in business. They want to go somewhere where they can like look good and make money. Like if you're a bat in the final year of your contract, or you're just starting off something new or whatever, like, don't you want to be protected by all those bats around you? Get a couple more good swings per game.
Yeah, you can do a whole lot of winning here. I hope the Jays reach out to like an Edwin Encarnacion, who the other day was waxing poetically about just how much he loved Toronto. You know, go and find these veteran players and just whisper in the ears going, listen, I know the Mets are going to bowl you over with an offer because, you know, richest owner, embarrassing year. They got to try to put so much of that behind them. Or the Angels, who are going to be desperate to win with Ohtani and Mike Trout. But, you know, there's got to be a way. You got to get these veteran retired players in the ears of Simeon, and also Robbie Ray. They go, hey, Robbie, there's Pete Walker. He helped you. I mean, you did a lot of work, obviously, on your own, and you put in the time and effort, but Pete Walker helped you.
Yeah. You know, I brought up Al Leiter last time and how we got him to where he could be great, and he went and did it for the Mets. Mm-hmm. I don't know that these guys have any loyalty because they're not expecting the team to show them any, and they probably shouldn't have any loyalty. And if you can go and get that money, you have to, right? But the point is, to your point, they could do that here. I was, you know, you bring up Edwin Encarnacion. I was struck by both Josh Donaldson after the Minnesota series and also Marcus Stroman yesterday, two guys who got to play here when things were hopping, and they both talked about how they felt bad for these guys that they haven't seen the Toronto fans in full flight yet. I think that it's really, for a lot of reasons, but it's really too bad that the Dome didn't get to be 50,000 strong so that people around baseball could see what the culture is like here. Of course, it's going to seem a little more subdued when you're not allowing 25,000 extra people through the door.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really excited for next year, as everybody is. Obviously I have big questions about the offseason, but regardless, I think we'll be excited no matter what happens because they still got the best player in baseball. And who doesn't want to go watch Vlad play, you know? I feel like in terms of selling the culture, we haven't been able to do that because of COVID. And hopefully over the offseason, they can make a compelling case that Toronto actually has an amazing sports culture.
And that's part of on Rogers. That's on Shapiro and Atkins to make sure that they the money isn't an issue, and B, they sell everything else to try to bring both of them back.
I don't know how it's going to work, but you know, I will say this though, I'm more disappointed than I thought I would be. And I think it's because it looked like it was going to happen. And then it was 2 ninth-inning reversals. Like it really yes. was.
It was a tease.
Yeah. You felt like you were through. Like I was glued, you know, it's funny. Like I was following on all the games yesterday, as I'm sure everyone was. And then, you know, after we won so big and I was pretty sure the Yanks had a pretty good chance to win. It was, you know, 0-0 for a long time, but I was pretty sure at the very least the Sox were going to lose. And I kind of let go of my attention a little bit, only to discover an hour later that this whole thing had gone south. It's like, we were like 85% of the way there.
It was so cruel, Bob. It was so cruel. And I'm up here at the cottage by myself. And I'm at this point, like I'm looking and I see 5-1 Washington and I'm feeling so good. So now I'm going back to watching like the Cards Rams football game. And then my eyes flicker over and I'm seeing that score. I'm like, no. And then it's 0-0 and Rays and Yankees. And it was a gut punch. It was a gut punch day for every reason, because we got teased, because of the unfairness, because, you know, you see the Jays clobbering, all this stuff. And in the end, the White Sox are in the playoffs and the Jays aren't. All these other teams that Toronto's clearly better than, they're in the playoffs and Toronto isn't.
Well, I think it's not a hot take to say that this has been unfair, but it's the most accurate take, I think. You can always argue maybe the team could have done something differently, but they did so many things right that given the obstacles they had to face, COVID being the big one, Dunedin being the big one, really, even more so than the AL East in a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, is there any satisfaction in being able to say the game was rigged?
No, there's no satisfaction, because tomorrow the Yankees and the Red Sox will be playing a wild card game. And, you know, I'll be looking back at the Raptors 76ers. How did Scotty Barnes look in his first exhibition game?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Raptors there, because Masai was adamant, we're not going back to doing what we did during COVID. Like, this team needs to get back. And maybe it's hard for us as fans to really fully understand how difficult it was for these guys to play in the way that they did. For us, it's extremely disappointing that we can't go see the live games, but we can still watch them at least. It's a muted experience, but it's impossible to know how hard it must be to never really have a home game. I don't think the players are totally honest about it either, because I don't think they want to make excuses. But I'm sure under like truth serum, they would say this really fucking sucked.
Yep. And they've said it from time to time. And alluded. I think also they want to be a little bit careful because, you know, as they say, the city of Tampa was great to them. They did, you know, they did everything they could. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Athletes don't want to do sour grapes, fair or unfair. It's why, you know, even this discussion, I prefaced it off the top. The word fair is a dicey one when it comes to sports, where at the end of the day, it's about did you win or did you lose? But you got to put the context in it. But yeah, no, I mean, and the big picture here is, what's that?
I've been thinking a lot about this idea of fairness and equality, because we kind of have grown up to think of the things as the two of the same things, like two birds of a feather. If we're equals, then it must be fair because we have equality. But when you think about it, equality does not guarantee fairness, because there are a lot of ways that life is unfair, even if all the rules are the same. You know, you talked about it being a meritocracy. Well, a meritocracy is the opposite of fair, unless you're really smart or strong. It's like you've been determined ahead of before you were even born. The second you came out, it's like there was a cap on how good you could do based on what you were born with. I know people will say, oh, but you can work extra hard, you know. Okay, sure. As I like to say, you make your own luck tends to be the saying of people who have had good luck. I don't think any of this was fair, and I don't think any of it was equal, you know, but we're used to sports being, at the very least, everybody has a chance to win and it's up to you. I'm not even sure they really had a chance to win.
they had a less of a chance because they're the only team displaced. It's not like half the league was displaced. They were the only one. And sports, there's no such thing as pure 100% meritocracy. But at least in sports, if you're the starting linebacker, it's not because your dad owns the team. It's because, you know, you kicked ass in the SEC in training camp and, you know, in the preseason and you earned the job. Like, there is a higher level of meritocracy in sports than in probably almost every other facet. It's not 100%. It can't be. And it just, in this case, it felt like the Jays did everything right and it didn't matter.
You know, it's funny you say that. Can I sidebar, but like sports related sidebar here?
Sure.
I was thinking about Trevor Lawrence and I was thinking about what you said with regards to how bad that organization is and how bad these organizations are generally. And who was ever a great quarterback that didn't have a great coach or great team or great mentor, right?
Yep.
And when you think about it, like, how many players could have had a better career if they didn't have the bad luck to wind up where they did? They might not have been like Hall of Famers, but I mean, someone that we think of as not very good could actually have been pretty good. Someone who played 4 years in the league and then never found their footing could have played 12 if they would have had the right start. Like, how often do you think that happens if you had to guess?
All the time. I will go with, I know they lost to the Rams. Matt Stafford's been incredible.
Yeah.
He left the Lions and went to the Rams. And sorry, they lost. Yeah, they lost to the Cards, but that's him. I mean, I could go up and down and give you examples.
And I think you're right. And in that regard, when we talk about meritocracy, I think even sports, sometimes we forget how much environment and culture and even just good luck to land somewhere where you can show what you have to do and be taught what you have to do. I think sometimes we put too much emphasis on athletes to somehow magically transform their situations into good ones. Like, some situations are just, they suck. And, you know, no wonder guys want to get the help. That's why I think it's so important to establish culture for the Jays right now, because you don't want to develop these guys and then they look around and say, thank God I survived that. Let me go somewhere where I can really fly. I think what's going to sell the team to these players is the team. Like, you have to look at it and say, I'm going to do great here. You know, you talked about winning. Winning is a symptom. You know what I mean? Winning isn't a cause. Winning is an effect. Pardon the pun. And I think the Raptors have shown a good job of this. Like, even though they've taken some real lumps lately, they always feel like a team that's on the rise. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, okay, you know, I don't even have them winning 36 games this year, but I think that's very temporary. The Jays have to get to a point where, like, you know, any other number of teams, players look at them and say, that would be a good place to show what I can show, because they're in the game of doing that, because that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
We got to show the culture is not the Jacksonville Jaguars, where a Trevor Lawrence can be great, but not thrive.
You sell it on Robbie Ray. Here's Pete Walker. You sell it to Simeon. You're going to be batting with Teoscar Hernandez, Bo Bichette, Vlad Guerrero Jr. By the way, next year, here's some tape of what 2015 and 16 looked like. We're going to have that next year. You love the city. And by the way, we're Rogers. We're going to give you lots and lots and lots of money.
And phones.
And all the phones you want.
Unlimited phone time.
And really nice cases where your screen will never break.
The ones like where it's all like in rhinestones.
Ooh.
Yeah. People love their phone cases.
Yeah, they do. I think you can guess how much I care about my phone case.
Yeah, me too. I went to the Pacific Mall a couple of weeks ago because Charlotte's really into anime and she wanted to go and just get some like stuff. And it was like one in every three shops was a phone case shop. One in every five was bubble tea.
Bubble tea is disgusting.
I don't really get it. She loves it, but I think she's trying to make a point. I had it once, and honestly, it was sort of like, what if you took a perfectly good cup of tea and put phlegm in it?
Yes. Actually, Bob, you nailed it. I don't know what's going on. Like, I drink it, and I'm confused, but I'm not enjoying myself.
it's like they're cropping up everywhere. I walked up and down Yonge Street the other day, and honestly, there were so many bubble tea shops. I guess because it's cheap and you can sell it for an incredible markup. Because it really is just water, a tea bag, and a bunch of phlegm, and you're selling it for $8.
Yeah.
Do you ever look at restaurants and think, like, what's your profit margin and how hard it must be to make money in certain worlds? Like, you ever notice how, like, there was a million Thai or sushi places that popped up about 10, 15 years ago? But, like, what's pad Thai? It's noodles.
Yeah.
What's sushi? Well, it's, like, mostly rice.
By the way, and no, you're right about that. Actually, I always wonder about those places. I mean, they must make so much money in terms of markup on food because those places traditionally don't make a lot of money selling booze, certainly not bottles of wine, which is where restaurants make their money from. Right. But talk about things popping up. I'm all for the marijuana, the Lady Jane, as it's known. But right. Is there more cannabis stores than Tim Hortons stores in Toronto?
It feels like all of Canada now is just going to get a nice chilled buzz from weed and then go right to Tim Hortons so they can pick themselves up with a coffee.
Yeah.
Just like rinse, wash, repeat. I actually don't love it. I think it's kind of stupid. It seems like the marijuana business is, it's gigantic in the sense of volume, but there are way more losers than I think people thought there would be. I think everyone thought, like, you know, kind of like .com. It's sort of, remember in The Simpsons when they printed the stock on toilet paper?
Yep.
I kind of feel like people thought they were, you know, being handed a golden ticket and what they got was toilet paper stock.
I miss used bookstores or any bookstores. I wish there was more books. Like just give me like 10% more bookstores where there is cannabis stores. That's all I want.
So, okay, let's do this. Let's talk about things we miss and things we don't need more of. So we don't need more phone cases. Yep. We don't need more bubble tea. We don't need more marijuana dispensaries.
Yes.
We do need more bookstores.
Yes.
I would like more human people at checkout. I went to Dollarama the other day and there was just one person pointing to what machine you checked yourself out at. And it felt really lonely and horrible and futuristic and dystopian. I miss, even if the lines were a little longer, I miss knowing that there was a human being at the end of this transaction. I feel the same way about bank tellers. And I know people will say, oh, but it's slow and it's this and it's that. But honestly, there's nothing quite as dehumanizing to me than when the ATM says with its little print, have a nice day. I don't think you can.
You are 100% right. A couple quick thoughts on this. I'll try not to go more than 17 minutes.
Okay, I'll hang up and listen.
I'll take the answer offline. I feel bad for the people working there at the tellers or at cashier, and they're staring at the machines because those machines will eventually represent you being replaced. A lot of those jobs are great entry-level jobs for people just getting into the workforce. So losing that, I think, is a massive deal. Also, just empathy creation. Go to the cashier. Ask how they're doing. I always ask, how are you doing? How's your day? And a follow-up question. You know, I legitimately want to know. Same thing going into the bank teller. I'll never deposit a check in a machine. It scares me. But you're absolutely right. I want more humans, and I want fewer machines.
In order to be a human, you have to act like a human. And the more you interact with technology, the less we actually remember how to act around people because we don't practice. We forget. We see this now. Like, I went on the subway for the first time this weekend in like a year and a half, and it was weird. And it's, you know what actually really hit me was how normal it was to me before. Like, it seemed, I practically lived on the subway in the winter because I don't drive. So I take TTC everywhere. It's a huge part of my life. And then I didn't do it for a year and a half. And all of a sudden it felt weird. And I think a lot of people are experiencing this as they try to get back into life. You know, how do I just go out and have a normal dinner with people? How do I go to a party and mingle? Like, things that were kind of semi-awkward before have become very, very avoidable now. In order to be a human, you have to practice being human. And to your point about like saying hi to the teller, 100%. To your point about entry-level jobs, 100%. It's bad for kids. It's bad for people who don't have college degrees. people who need to work, as automation sucks up all of these jobs more and more, we give these people fewer and fewer places to get the resources they need in order to get the leg up that everyone says they have to go get. You know, it's like we've started kicking the rungs out of the bottom of the ladder, and we keep telling people at the bottom, why aren't you climbing? How did this pertain to the Jays again?
It didn't, but we're here. Oh, it was about cannabis stores, and it's things we want to see more of and things we want to see less of. And one final thought on this, like, I was always the chatty guy, but Amy pushed it to another level. And I see the genuine look of happiness in the face of people working as cashiers or tellers when they can tell, oh, this person genuinely does care how my day is. And they're actually having this conversation. And I see it over and over again. And we live in a world now where technology is just basically saying you never have to leave your home. Every movie ever done is on your TV, and that special favorite fish taco can now be delivered to your home. You never have to leave your door. And I've never done that. I've done Uber Eats once since the start of COVID, and I refuse to do it.
You and Amy are very friendly people. Yeah. I think that we grew up in an era where being friendly was something that you admire. If somebody was really friendly, you admired that about them. I feel like friendliness now is sort of seen almost as like quaint and nostalgic. And I fear that generations down the road, friendliness will be seen as a waste of time and energy.
Hopefully it goes, you know, it's like music went from hair bands to grunge, you know, hopefully it goes back and forth when it comes to this.
All right. Well, since we're talking about everything old is new again, it was actually a pretty lousy game in Foxborough last night. I didn't make it to the end. Did you?
Yep.
Okay. You probably had to, because one, you have to work. Two, you're probably more into the actual football of it than I was. Thoughts on how they celebrated the record? Let's start there.
Whatever. The funny thing is about the yardage record, it kept going back and forth between Breeze and Brady last year that it just felt really anticlimactic. And also in football, this isn't baseball. Most records no one cares about.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Like, you know, all-time touchdown leader is not the same as all-time home run leader.
Not even close.
Yeah, it's just a totally different game. Speaking of different game, man, Brady needs Gronkowski, eh?
Oh God, it's funny you mention that. One of my notes: Brady was not great equals rain plus no Gronk. You saw overthrows from Brady in the first quarter, then also mainly in the red zone. There was a drop pass by Cameron Brate early in the third quarter on a 2nd and 6. But yes, Gronk. I mean, it's funny. Like, yeah, you know, we wondered how much he had left in him. He's looked great when he's played. He looked even better by not being on the field.
That's a great way to put it. You really saw how amazing he is through his absence. Too big to be guarded by fast guys, too fast to be guarded by big guys. He really is just an impossible problem to solve. He's the blanket that just isn't big enough. Something's getting left uncovered. In general, you know, I watched a lot of the Bills game. Thankfully, you know, I mean, it turned into a total butt whooping, but that first quarter looked like it was going to be one of those awful, like 7-3 games that you get in the middle of a snowstorm. Like, Josh Allen sailed the first couple passes. That poor sacrificial lamb from the Texans, he was lucky to even hold on to the ball. Thankfully, it got better, but I have a controversial take because I know that people love the inclement weather game. I actually don't like it. I feel like I can't watch a game of football. I'm watching a game of Survive the Element.
I get it, but I love I don't need it all the time. For me, it's not, I don't like rain and wind, but you give me one of those snow games where no one has any idea what the yardage thing is. Give me one or two of those a year and I'm happy. I don't need it all the time, but I do enjoy it once or twice.
I think it teaches nothing. Mm-hmm. And it sucks if it's in the playoffs and there's actually huge stakes. Now, there are times where, you know, when your team isn't as good as the other one, you're glad because it obviously it equalizes everything. I don't know. Like I watched last night. I thought I didn't learn anything about Brady because it was all explainable. He wasn't that great, but you know, Josh Allen didn't start off that great. And I know Josh Allen's good. No Gronk. What did we learn about the Patriots?
We learned Mac that Jones is good.
He's good.
Yeah, like Mac Jones to me, like this was a bad game, a boring game. Brady didn't look great. For me, the only good thing was Mac Jones. He did well against the blitz. He had 19 consecutive completions. And yes, I know it was all short stuff. And Mac Jones is not ready at that point to be Justin Herbert, but he might not be that. I mean, he's probably not that guy, but he's not the guy that's going deep, beating you deep. To me, the weirdest thing, why did Belichick kick a 56-yarder? Tampa was without all their defensive backs. Refs were throwing lots of flags, and he looked good, and Mac Jones looked good. Like, kicking a 56-yarder in the rain versus going for it on 4th-and-3, I don't understand that.
Did he explain it after the game?
I haven't heard any of the post-game, but I imagine it was a lot of mumbling, and more people cared about, you know, Belichick going to the locker room, having a private, like, 23-minute conversation with Brady. And it was covered, like, are they making out? Like, oh, they've been alone together for 20 minutes. It felt like, you know, 7 minutes in heaven in the closet or something.
That's really funny. 7 minutes of heaven. Good reference.
Thank you.
After about a quarter and a half, like, you asked a totally reasonable football question that I totally don't care about. Because that game had nothing to do with football, in my opinion. If it had been really close and there'd been like something really, well, it was really close, but if it had been really exciting and you got sucked into the narrative, maybe then. But really, it kind of felt like the story of the game was the story going into the game. And once it started, it was a total snooze fest. And yep. I was prepared to move on past it. You have to cover it professionally, but I'll be honest with you, Matt. My other than saying he really needed Gronk, I watched about a quarter and a half of it and thought, this is dull and life is short.
Yes. No, you're right. Aesthetically, it was a boring game. And unfortunately, the only way it would have been interesting would have been if the field goal is good and New England's defense stops Brady. A Tampa Bay loss would have made that at least a little bit more compelling. But Justin Folk missing a 56-yarder, that made a game that was already aesthetically boring, it made it narratively boring as well.
Let's go just a little bit up the East Coast. I thought Zach Wilson looked pretty good. I watched that overtime, and he made some really nice throws. He made a couple rookie mistakes, and he missed a couple guys. He could have scored a touchdown on 3rd-and-5, I think it was, but he threw a kind of a mediocre pass. But generally speaking, it was the first time that I think he looked like someone who could turn into a good quarterback. Are you a believer in the turnaround performance, or do you think there can just be like these occasional spikes, but generally guys who are going to fail are going to fail?
I give the boring answer. It's something in between. Titans aren't a great team on defense. They were missing a couple guys. However, considering how bad the Jets had been, considering just them being blown out, for Zach Wilson, 232 yards, couple touchdowns in the fourth quarter, that is important. That's important just for him just to grow as a player and a human, and it's important for him just to have that positive reinforcement in the memory bank. No. That was an important game for the Jets.
It felt like an important game, and it kind of felt like for a team that doesn't have much and hasn't had much in a long time, to win on your quarterback's arm. You know, we saw this with Geno Smith. Remember when Geno Smith was going to be the answer?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Rex Ryan was the answer, and they, it kind of was for a short period of time, but, you know, you don't want to get too excited. I want to punt this over to Trevor Lawrence because, you know, Urban Meyer called the loss to the Bengals heartbreaking. Is the media protecting Lawrence at this point?
What I think it is the media in general, like, well, I shouldn't say in general, the media doesn't like Urban Meyer. So right. Urban's going to get the slings and arrows. Also, the media doesn't really like Jacksonville, and they don't. And by the way, Jacksonville doesn't deserve the benefit of the doubt. And also, all the media did, including myself, was touting this guy to be the next Andrew Luck, we don't like to be wrong. So what do we, it's like the Stephen A. Smith thing. He always gets angry at the team that loses when he predicted they would win. He doesn't go, I was wrong. He just yells at the team. So they, for us,
I said they would do and should have done.
Yeah, exactly. So we're doing, it's like, no. Trevor Lawrence, it's not him. And we can do the pie chart of blame. But for me, the pie chart still goes first on that organization. It doesn't go on Trevor Lawrence yet. But yeah, I mean, Lawrence has got to be better as well, obviously.
Yeah, it's just so funny. Like, I feel narrative determines how we're going to talk about people. Like, Mac Jones has looked pretty good. But I don't think Mac Jones, anyone thinks he's going to be Aaron Rodgers. You know what I mean? Nope. Trevor Lawrence, people have decided is going to be Aaron Rodgers. So he gets the benefit of the doubt. People feel like Zach Wilson. Oh, I think he's just like, he looks like William Nylander and I hate the Jets and they always do stupid things. So we've decided he's bad. Yes. Justin Fields. Well, you know, the Bears always get this kind of thing wrong. Remember Mitch Trubisky, you know, game, set, match, he's going to suck. And now Trey Lance, I find interesting. What's your take on him?
Trey Lance is the mystery. Trey Lance, yeah. You know, he's Trey Lance probably has the highest ceiling and the lowest floor. That's kind of how I view him. He's in a great situation just with that coaching staff, and they got plenty of weapons. But to me, he's the mystery. He's the girl at the end of the bar who, while all the other girls, you know, have a glass of Pinot Grigio or something. She's got some mysterious cocktail. You don't know what's going on over there.
She's got like, there's like smoke rising from it.
Thank you. Yes. It looks like a drink from Star Trek 3.
Exactly. You ever notice in the future that all glasses, like everyone drinks only out of highball glasses in the future?
It's highball. It's usually a weird color of blue.
Blue.
And there's always some sort of steam.
I've always said, you know, a movie takes place in the future if the drinks are blue.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and one other thing. I can't take credit for this. This is Corolla. No denim. No one in the future wears jeans.
Well, it's funny. It used to be black president.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It was always a black president. Then we had one, and it didn't seem quite as futuristic. But, you know, Morgan Freeman was always like the imaginary president of the future. No denim. God, that's a great observation. I've never seen jeans. You know, Actually, you know what kind of made it cool at the beginning of Star Trek was when he had that car and Kirk was driving the car through the Iowa cornfields.
Yep.
It was nice to see a car in the future. That was cool.
Yeah, you're right. God, that was such a good movie. Oh, J.J. Abrams nailed that one.
You know, I didn't love his work on the Star Wars trilogy, but he really did a good job of that Star Trek reboot. I even like the second one.
Yeah. I enjoyed that as well.
Are you going to watch the Star Trek anime? The Star Wars anime? I think I might have asked.
Probably not. There's too much on TV. And also, Bob, I did something on I think it was like Thursday night. I went to the movies. Oh. It was awesome. I was in a movie theater, popcorn. We snuck in a bottle of wine. It was so nice.
Yeah, what'd you see?
It's so bad. I forget the title. The Marvel movie, the Legend of Ten Rings.
Oh, Shang-Chi?
Yeah.
Yeah, did you like it?
I did. I enjoyed it. Now, I will say this. No matter what the movie was, I was probably going to like it a little bit more no matter what. But, you know, good humor in it. Awkwafina is awesome. I can watch her in anything. I thought he did a really good job pulling off superhero. So, yes, I liked it. And the villain, you know, good, flawed, you know, the tragic, flawed villain character. It hit all the buttons for me.
I'm really looking forward to it. I want to see it as well. I haven't gone yet. What you described, though, it reminds me when Sandra and I, about, I'm going to say, like somewhere between 6 to 12 months after Charlotte was born, we hadn't gone to the movie and we really hadn't done anything. Like it took us about 4 months even to shower. Like it's a pretty crazy experience. And the first movie we went to go see was Iron Man 2. And we sat there with our drinks and our popcorn and we sank into the seats. And that movie is the worst piece of shit. And we had the best time any two human beings ever had.
It's true.
You make such a great point. Like Shang-Chi, could have been, honestly, it could have been Megaforce, but worse. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't matter because you were in the dark with your girl and some wine and some popcorn and life is bliss.
100%.
I really want to watch the Bond movie.
Oh, I can't wait.
You know, that looks so potentially awesome. I give them such credit for particularly Daniel Craig, but even the filmmakers around it for reviving that brand. It kind of felt cheesy for a long time, and they've kind of turned it into like prestige action. Great villains, like the last three or four Bond flicks, like, you know, even Quantum of Solace, which isn't awesome, is still pretty awesome. And now it's like, to me, for so long, and I grew up a Bond kid, but then, you know, during the 90s, it kind of dropped off totally. And it's Destination now again. Is Bond Destination for you?
Yep. Oh, yeah. No, I'll see it. Even actually, I found Spectre a little bit flawed, but whatever. I'm here for all of it. I think the funny thing is get like a 22-year-old who's, you know, a Daniel Craig is their James Bond. Show them Roger Moore and just watch us. Like, they'll be so confused.
Honestly, Roger Moore looks like a creepy tennis coach at the country club who's just trying to like pick up like old ladies so that they'll get the check for dinner.
Careful, Bob. Roger Moore is my James Bond, but you're not wrong.
He's the worst.
He's the best. No actor. I'd like to find out the stat. Which actor spent the least amount of time on screen and just used stunt doubles? I feel like Roger Moore used a stunt double when he was just running, you know, just running out of a cab.
I don't. Yeah, exactly. I think he puts his hand on the door to open the cab door. Cut. All right. Great. That door was heavy. Get the stunt guy in to open this door. You know who needs to be revised a little bit, though? Like revisited? I think Timothy Dalton, because he kind of had like a mean Bond. Like he was kind of more of an assassin, more of a cold-blooded killer. I feel like that would do really well right now. Like Daniel Craig, I think, borrows a lot from Timothy Dalton.
His first one, and I know I'm going to get it wrong, I think it was Living Daylights, was awesome. But then he did one called License to Kill, which was really bad and just felt like an 80s cocaine movie. Yeah. But Timothy Dalton was great in Hot Fuzz.
You just created, and I don't know if this is a thing and I've never heard of it or if you just made it up, but 80s cocaine movie. Mm-hmm. Did you just make that up?
Yeah.
I feel like we need to dedicate an entire pod to what are the ultimate 80s cocaine movies.
That'll take a little, that's going to need a little bit of research.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe next week, like when we get back to it, we go back to our top fives. And our first top five will be top five movies from the 80s that were clearly influenced by cocaine.
Oh, God. So then my first question is, was Spielberg on cocaine for Howard the Duck, or was that George Lucas? Like someone was on cocaine.
That was George Lucas.
Okay. Lucas was just freewheeling the coke on that one.
Well, see, 70s cocaine movies are movies like Mean Streets. Or Sorcerer by William Friedkin, like these auteurs that just went mad with power and drugs and they all turned into Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now. But like there's art there. There's just insane art. In the 80s, it was just, you know, Leo DiCaprio and Wolf of Wall Street. It was just like dudes with so much money are like, man, this scene would be good in a car, but let's make it a helicopter.
Bob, I mean, I think I could do my list right now. Mannequin. Howard the Duck, Weekend at Bernie's Part 2. God, I feel like I could rattle off all these movies. We're like, what the hell were you doing? What were you thinking?
You know what movie ages well? Not as well as Die Hard, but better than you might think, is that first Lethal Weapon.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's still good. It's not Die Hard, but it's still really good. I watched it again recently, and like the music is cheesy, the style is cheesy, but you know, great villain, great anti-hero. Danny Glover's fantastic. I feel like that movie, like a lot of Richard Donner movies, is underrated because they're so good at being successful that you forget, like, this is super well made.
And as for the Blue Jays, Bob, I'm getting too old for this shit.
Bye, Matt.
Bye, Bob.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.